I believe that Christian men today, Jim and Mike, need reassurance that the way they are is perfectly normal. And I say that because there is a lot of guilt in good men about their sexuality.
Well, this is Focus on the Family, and that was Dr. Archibald Hart, our guest on the last edition of this broadcast. Today we're going to continue to discover what it means to be male, sexual, and normal, and I promise you a fascinating conversation. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout, not only encouraging you to stay tuned, but give someone else a quick call and encourage them to join us as well for this broadcast. Our discussion yesterday may have been a little bit much for younger listeners. That probably will be the case again today. However, if your preteen or teenager is on the mature side, especially the males, you might want to encourage them to listen along. Doctor?
Well, Mike, back with us for day two on the subject of the sexual man, which is the title of his book, is Dr. Arch Hart, who is a licensed psychologist in the state of California, a professor of the Graduate School of Psychology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena. Dr. Hart has been a great friend to this ministry, and he and his wife, Kathleen, are great friends to Shirley and me. Arch, I'm always glad to have you here.
It's always wonderful to visit Focus on the Family.
You have a way of writing books that really do zero in on the central problems that families face. And we have done many programs on your books in the past. This one is especially interesting, The Sexual Man. Let me start. Let's just plunge in. We were kind of discussing it in a generic way last time. Let me ask you, from the research on which this book was based, it's called The Hart Report, a landmark study of men and sex in the 90s. From that research, what are the common fears and frustrations that men especially face? What are the sources of discomfort for men as opposed to women?
I think that the average good man, the men that I studied for this book, the question uppermost in their mind is the question, am I normal? They sense a great disparity between their sexual needs and the sexual needs of their partners. Now, I have been rightly taken to task by several women who say, my problem is my husband has no interest in sex. You know, and they are those.
Your book says only about 5%.
Only about 5% or so, yes. But there are some situations where that is the problem. But the vast majority of healthy, normal men are, while they report a high level of sexual fulfillment, according to my study, there's a large percentage of them who are saying that they are just not fulfilled enough of the time. And so there's a fair amount of complaining going on the part of men about their lack of adequate fulfillment.
Do you think men are more satisfied with their sexual relationship in marriage than their wives are?
I that's a difficult question for me to answer. From my therapy, I see a lot of women who are dissatisfied. Now, they're not asking for more sex. They're asking for the quality of the sex.
Yeah.
They're asking for relationship. They're saying, you know, my husband comes home, he doesn't talk to me, I serve dinner, and then straight after dinner he wants to go to bed. When I've been alone all day, I want relationship. I want something deeper than that. And it's this disparity between what men apparently need and what women need that is the source of a lot of the tension between couples.
Now, Arch, there are a lot of ways that a man could ask that question, am I normal? Am I mentally normal? Am I physically normal? Am I a normal athlete? Mm-hmm. But you're specifically in this book talking about the sexual drive and the level of that drive.
Yes.
And am I normal when I'm thinking about having sex 24 hours a day?
That's the question that they ask. Most men ask the question, am I normal? Because they experience the drive as such a powerful drive. Mm-hmm. It's powerful in that
that
it's
couldn't
ever
be normal,
present.
Right? It couldn't be normal to have that force raging inside.
It's ever present. I mean, it's amazing how often their thoughts will go to it. I noticed many of them were reported the fact that often they would go to lunch with a person in the work situation, and the male all the time is thinking about the sexual side of their relationship, where seldom does a woman go to lunch with somebody and think about it in those terms. So am I normal? You know, why is there something wrong with me that I should be always thinking in
and,
those
and you're
terms?
Saying through this book that is normal.
Yeah, I'm saying it's normal in the sense that it's the average. It's what everyone is doing. It's not normal. What you do with it is really the question you have to ask, whether it's normal what you do with it. But I would say this, however, that in the workplace, men do not stop being sexual.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very important point that has tremendous implications.
That takes us almost directly into the issue of the political correctness of sexual harassment that has become such a talking point, here, at least here in the United States. And let me preface what I'm about to say by agreeing that it should not occur and a woman shouldn't have to put up with that. And we're not condoning that. I'm not condoning
that
in
any regard.
It's an absolute scourge.
It's a scourge, Jim.
But I do have to tell you, Arch, that it seems the way it's now administered, I'm talking about the law, seems a bit unfair to me because there are no limitations on how a woman dresses and how she flirts and how she uses her sexuality in a workplace. Then if a man takes the bait, his company may pay a $7 million fine or fee or judgment, just as occurred in, I think it was Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
There's some inequity there someplace.
Yeah.
A woman can tempt a man, and if he then responds, he's in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm. I was reading in some magazines recently, some women's magazines, articles about how to use your sexuality to influence your boss to get on with the men around you. I mean, women's
magazines.
That's
dirty pool now.
Oh, that's
you can't have it both ways.
You can't have it both ways. And in my book, I come down very, very strongly on the responsibility that women have to dress appropriately in the workplace. And so in the book, I forget how many, but most of the men said that the provocative dress, the inappropriate dress by women, was a major source of sexual arousal for them.
Mm. This is a fascinating subject to me, and I've talked to my wife Shirley about it, especially how quickly a woman can discern a man's vulnerability at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They know it instantly.
That's because every man's vulnerable. Maybe.
Yeah, but some, as you know, are far more vulnerable than others.
Some will work it.
We went out to dinner one time with there were about 8 or 10 people in the party, and one of them was a well-known Christian leader. And my wife Shirley came home and she said, "That man's in danger." She said, "I can tell." She sensed it. I didn't pick it up at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, he fell shortly after that. She could just tell by the way he looked at her. And the way he related to
her. That's right. Yeah.
There is that that sensitivity there.
I wouldn't want to give the impression that all the blame rests with women, and not at all. But I think that there needs to be, in every workplace, a company that does not have appropriate dress policies should not be surprised if it gets sued for fostering sexual harassment.
Yeah, Arch, I wouldn't blame it all on women either. What I fear is most of it's being blamed on men. Sexual harassment only goes one direction, and men sometimes are victims of traps that are laid. Mm. Let's be honest.
Oh, that's right.
And then there are other situations where men are dead guilty of abusing women and taking advantage of the power that they have in the workplace.
And we're back now again to how men and women see things differently. I mean, there may be a party at the office going on, and a man on one side of the room looks across the room at another woman, and she looks back at him, and she smiles at him. He's thinking, she's interested in me sexually.
Yeah.
She's thinking, he's a nice person, he wants to be friends with me. And this difference in perception that is so pervasive often leads the male to think that the cues he's getting is an invitation to do things that, in fact, is not an invitation at all.
Well, the last general question that I asked you, Arch, was to define the common frustrations and fears that men face. Describe for us now the common ways men think about sex.
Mm-hmm. I think that what was very clear from my study was the overwhelming evidence that when men think about sex, they primarily think visually. They're thinking in visual terms. They have images.
That's why they're so vulnerable to pornography.
And exactly. That is why pornography is so dangerous to men, because those images get locked into their mind, keep coming up. And the problem with it is that it's not reality, you see. And for many of them, they become dissatisfied with what they see at home. It's not up to the standard of the airbrushed lies that have been
presented. What can compete with it?
What can compete with that sort of thing? And so it feeds a lot of fantasy. It also leads men to think dirty. I was rather appalled at how men in the sexual arena have a dirty streak, an almost desire to focus on the unsavory aspects of sexuality. And you wonder to what extent that has been fed by the pornographic industry. I mean, I don't know that we could invent that stuff if we were never exposed to it.
You are one of the nation's experts on addictive behavior arts. Let me pose a situation that I'll bet you some of our listeners are thinking about right now and ask you to respond to it. Let's suppose there's a couple out there someplace that has kind of a bored sex life. The man is visual, and he doesn't have a lot of stimulation from their sex life. She likes to have sex in the dark, and that's his primary source of interest. And so they talk about it and decide maybe what we need is to get some pornographic videos to jazz up our relationship a little bit. Now, maybe that will turn us on. Maybe we can bring some new life into that sexual relationship externally and artificially. What is your caution to them?
I am so appalled by... I know it's done. I know it is very common. I know that even some good sex therapists, Christian sex therapists, might even advocate that you do that. But this study has absolutely convinced me of the unsatisfactoriness of that for several reasons. One, that it feeds the male's addictive need. And it feeds the male's visual need and fantasy need in a way.
Without meeting the female's
Without
need.
Meeting the wife's needs, the female needs. So it's women who don't like that stuff. Men love it. Women hate it, by and large. And it detracts from what I think to be the primary purpose of the sex act, which is to foster a growth in intimacy and closeness. Yeah. The experiencing of this moment with this woman that I love. And couples who are into that stuff really will have to do some hard work to get back to a normal track. And a more fulfilling experience lies ahead for them if they can do that.
There's no shortcut to the romantic aspect of the relationship. I said in our first film, the Focus on a Family film series in 1978, you want to improve your sex life, work on the other 23 and a half hours in the day. Because that's where the sex is a natural outgrowth of that closeness and that romance.
It is, and one has to recover that in order to be healthy in your sexuality.
Hmm. Dealing again with the normal issue, what is normal, for the man who feels like his sex drive is abnormal because there is so much of it. What can he do other than changing the relationship with his wife and improving that? Mm-hmm. What can he do to take this drive and make it a positive in other areas?
Yes. Thank you, Mike. I think that perhaps the most important thing I can say about all of this is to lay out a few steps that I think are important in turning your sexuality. It may be normal, but we need to make it healthy. Mm. And I think that I want to make that distinction. You may be normal. You may be right in there with 99% of us, but that doesn't necessarily make it healthy. The top of the list for me is that for a normal male sexuality to be healthy, you've got to be accountable to somebody for it. And that means finding someone you can talk to, finding someone you can share openly.
Another man?
Preferably. I wouldn't advocate finding another woman. But, you know, many affairs have begun because the man, for the first time in his life, has found a sympathetic listening ear in another woman who he can begin to talk about his sexuality at a deep level. So I don't advocate another woman. I certainly your spouse, but often the conflict is so deep there that isn't a good place, not always open as the first place. You need to find a friend. And if you can't find a friend, go and find a good counselor. The second thing I think that men have to do in order to heal their sexuality is to begin to take control of their fantasy life, their thought life. This dirty track that runs in the mind of most men I know. It's something you have to begin to take control of. You've got to stop looking at every attractive woman who walks by or sits across from you or you see from the pulpit in sexual terms. Now, I know that I started my adult male life thinking always about women in sexual terms. And that's how it grows if you don't pay attention to it. But you need to begin to, you've got to catch those thoughts. You've got to stop yourself when you're doing it.
We were talking in the last program about teaching adolescents some of these principles. The church really ought to be doing that. You know, I remembered while you were talking just now something that happened when I was about 15 years of age that was long gone. It was obviously back there someplace. I was in gym class, and the guys and the girls had been separated. They were playing volleyball or something. We were playing basketball, and the coach, a man named Craig Ayers, Coach Ayers, had us all sit in the stands, and so he was talking to us. And a pretty girl walked out in front of us and across the other side of the gym, and all the guys hooted and howled and, you know, the old cat call and made suggestive comments. No, not much. like you said, Arch, guys are conditioned and taught to think that way. And that coach climbed our backs. He said, come on, what kind of animals are you? He said, you know, that is a human being over there that you're treating like an animal. You guys don't have to behave and act that way. Yeah. And it made an impact on me because it was the first time anybody in authority ever took on that that masculine idea that, that you know, the construction attitude toward a woman crossing the street and so on. We can teach some of those principles.
It's when you leave it to itself that it becomes distorted. I think that is obvious. The other important thing I believe that men have to do to develop a healthy sexuality is to get rid of whatever erotic material they have.
Absolutely.
There is a lot of it out there.
Arch, to summarize your book, The Sexual Man, you began by admitting that the sex drive is very strong and it influences just about everything in a normal man. But you don't let him off the hook.
No.
You also go on to the biblical understanding that we have an obligation to control this passion and this fire.
Yes, because, you know, statistics don't define for us what is right. But at the same time, I think we have to call men to a very careful and honest look at their sex drive and whether or not it is sanctified.
Arch, how about prayer? Did you study prayer at all and its impact on young men, especially as their parents pray for them, or perhaps on the man in a marriage situation when he and his wife pray together?
I did not study specifically the influence of prayer in this study. However, I do know that prayer plays a major role in the formation of boys through the critical stage of development of their sexuality. So while I did not study it specifically, I am utterly convinced that prayer is an important part of raising a healthy son. I think that that parents who pray with their sons over their sexuality can do an awful lot of reassuring, you know, where you bless them for their sexuality rather than inculcate their guilt over their feelings of sexuality. But, that principle is true in many areas of human life.
I think sometimes we forget about the power of prayer when it comes to a subject like this. Doctor, it looks like a lot of our friends in the gallery would like to ask some questions. We just have a couple of quick minutes here left at the end of the program. Can we try and squeeze in a few comments or questions from our visitors?
All right. Try to keep it very short because we're obviously trying to make good use of the time. And so don't go into a five-minute story. If you do, that will never get on the air, but just kind of try to keep it as concise as possible.
If they say something nice about you or me,
it's on the
most
air.
Most assuredly will be.
Yeah. You start with that, I mean, it's a foregone conclusion. Yeah. In fact, it'll be at the top of the program, right? Okay.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Chris Leonard from Laurel, Maryland. And I would like to ask Dr. Hart if he would address specifically the how-to of dealing with inappropriate sexual thoughts for the Christian man. By that, I mean the steps that he would go through to overcome his inappropriate sexual thoughts.
Thank you. I do have a section in the book, because that is so critical that I felt it needed some steps. Basically, the steps are these, that one has to increase one's awareness of when you're thinking these thoughts. There are many men having sexual thoughts, and they're just not, it's just, they're oblivious to the fact. So you have to increase your awareness. You have to catch yourself doing it. Then be honest enough to pull it out, even write it down so you can see what it is for what it is. And I know no other way but just to ask God to cleanse one's mind and take it away. It is the development of a discipline in which you honestly face up to when you are having those thoughts and then making the right choice as to what you do with them. I think that the other important principle is that unless you have a system of accountability, someone who is going to ask you some tough questions, someone who's going to say to you, and you know, at your time when you get together, maybe for a few minutes every day or every week or whatever, all right, now share with me what thoughts you've been having. And so you then have to honestly own up to that. I think that if we can just get it out of our mind and so we can see it for what it is, most of us are decent enough to say, I don't want to have it that way.
Last question.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Fred Van Scape, and I'm from Orange City, Iowa. You mentioned earlier that prayer, of course, had to be utmost in raising our young men, in teaching them to be upright men.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't agree more. My next question, and building on that, is how can I, in a practical way, in day-to-day carrying out my duties as a father with my four-year-old son, teach him the proper behavior of a male towards a female? And in dealing with his mother, with his sister, and with girls that he will be associating with in school.
You say a four-year-old?
Correct.
Yes. I think it begins back then. Thank you. You know, most parents begin to say, well, my son's 11, 12, looks like he's close to puberty. Perhaps now I should begin to address the issue of sexuality. It's too late. It is often too late. You've got to begin it back at age four. I think the way you teach respect for women, the way you respond to his behavior. I think some good old-fashioned values with respect to learning to open the door, learning to stand up when women come in. I mean, those are the sorts of things that put women in the place of respect that one can begin to shape the right feelings. Then as he gets older, at a little age four, he's probably hasn't even grasped the idea of sex. But as he gets older, through the 5, 6, 7, 8 year stage, one begins to broach the topic of sex and how important it is that we as men know how we can hurt girls and how we can harm them. And while it's something very beautiful and precious and must be reserved for the day when we can be married, you know, all of that stuff can be done in a wonderful way. But thank you for emphasizing the importance of starting that process very, very early in a boy's life.
Dr. Kevin Lehman wrote a book called Sex Begins in the Kitchen. And his theme was the way a husband relates to his wife, the respect he shows for her, even washing the dishes, is conveying something to the kids about sexuality.
Yeah. And now the father who goes in while mom's washing the dishes and grabs, that often happens, sometimes in front of the children, is not showing a respect.
That's right.
There's an appropriate behavior that is modeled by fathers, and children at a very young age begin to observe it.
Our guest has been Dr. Archibald Hart, psychologist at Fuller Theological Seminary. He's written a book called The Sexual Man, based on his study, a landmark study of men and sex in the 90s called The Hart Report. It's always fun to talk to you, Arch. I kind of feel like we could go away someplace and talk for 2 or 3 weeks and not run out of anything to say. It is good to have you with us. Thanks for coming to Colorado Springs. I hope your book is very widely read, not only by men, but by women as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, this concludes a two-part series here on Focus on the Family, dealing with perhaps a subject that is one of the most important we've covered in the last several months. We've been talking about Dr. Hart's book, The Sexual Man, Masculinity Without Guilt. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at this ministry, our website is family.org. That's www.family.org. This program is provided by Focus on the Family. Our producer has been Deanna Williams. Engineering and production were taken care of by Jim Adam and Steve Ryder. Mrs. Bobby Valentine is our executive producer. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. And I'm Mike Trout, inviting you back when we'll again turn our hearts toward home.